Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio,
on TV,
and online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy, and culture,
triplej.net.au.
And now,
good morning, Dom Alessio with you, being joined by the very esteemed Dr. Carl.
I'm not worthy for being esteemed. Do not trust authority. Trust nature.
Welcome, Dr. Carl. How are you doing this morning?
I'm very good, especially after our magnificent day yesterday with the weird red glow that hit the east coast of Australia.
Now, yeah, what were your first thoughts when you woke up and saw that the sky was just completely red?
Well, I was woken by the smell. Did you smell that musty sort of smell?
No, not really, yeah. I have to admit.
And so I opened the blinds and the windows, and it was red to the north, to the south, to the east, and the west, and straight above. And I knew that there was something odd going on. What happened was that millions of years ago, iron ore deposited on the west coast of Australia, on the western side. People have been mining this iron ore, putting it into trains that are 3 kilometres long, running it to enormous quarter-million-ton ships and then sending it overseas where we buy it back once it's had a bit of value added to it. But separately to that, over the last few million years, the wind has been blowing across Australia and eroding these mountains and making the red outback of Australia red because it's rust.
Oh, okay.
Ever had an old car which is rusting and the rust is red?
Yes, I did,
I'm talking your language, right? Yeah. Ever been out in the backyard and mixing up a few shovelfuls of bog to get it through red, Joe, yet one more time? Yeah, done that thing too. So the dust, the wind blows across Australia from the Indian Ocean. It comes in on the bottom half of Australia, gets two-thirds of the way across to roughly the Simpson Desert. That's the bottom left-hand corner of Queensland. Chucks a lefty, heads for the equator for a couple of hundred Ks, chucks another lefty and heads out to the Indian Ocean. And so you have the sand dunes being lined up in different ways following the wind. Then this dust sits as red iron ore. In the rest of the world, when they brought in the electric telegraph, we're talking mid-1800s, they had to have two wires, one for the electricity in, one for the electricity out. In Australia, you needed one wire, one for the electricity in, and you shove your return wire into the ground, and the ground carries enough electricity to carry it through the ground.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
Monitoring stations out at Birdsville, another one nearby, have been working for 10 years. They picked up the worst dust storm ever in their 10-year history a few days ago, earlier this week. It was 700 times worse than normal, but another difference, instead of just coming and going, it stayed.
Yeah.
The wind carried the light particles across to the coast. And that's what we in Sydney experienced, and then Brisbane yesterday, and then Brisbane yesterday afternoon and today.
Yeah, Brisbane is still suffering.
And my daughter, 11-year-old daughter, said, "Oh, Daddy, your Yakuta stinks." And she was sniffing it. It was the musty smell. So I reckon that besides the iron ore, there are also some organics in there.
Oh.
Pollen or something that could make people unwell.
Well, we have if you have a question for Dr. Carl, please call up now, 1-300-055-36. We do have some callers on the line at the moment. Let's see. Oh, it works. We have David from Brisbane. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing excellent. How are you?
Not doing too bad. Dr. Carl is here with me, and you have a question for him about the dust storm.
Yes, in Brisbane yesterday I noticed when I was driving around the sun was reflecting off the windscreens and cars as blue. When I actually got out and had a look, the sun appeared to be blue in a red dust storm.
Yeah. I had this experience once when I was in a skyscraper-type building, which is all glass, and I've been there for a few hours, and I look out the windows, and yeah, it's a blue sky, and it's a white sun. And then suddenly, I came to a window, which, because they had a cracker in the window, the repair people had pulled out the window, and suddenly I could see the outside world. And the outside world was tinted purple. Because the glass was green. So by looking through the green glass, my brain, which has a lifelong memory that the sky should be blue and the sun should be white, had shifted the colour balance. And then suddenly, there I was looking at a purple sun and a sort of dark blue sky. And it took about 5 minutes of just ignoring the outside world. And I had to stand near where the guys were working, so I asked their permission. And I made a little tunnel with my hands, and I just concentrated on the blue sky and the white sun, and it gradually turned blue over about 5-10 minutes. And then I walked back, and then suddenly I could see the glass being green again, and the sun being green, and then it took a while. So what you were seeing was a compensation. A technical term for this is habituation.
I thought that's what it was, except I took a photo of it, and the photo also appeared to be quite blue.
In that case, my theory is completely wrong. And in the photo, what do you see as blue?
The sun itself was appeared as white as you, when you looked at it, you know, because of the brightness, but around it, it was this very, very deep blue tinge. It was really quite eerie. It wasn't normal like you'd normally see in the sky. Maybe it was just contrasting to the red dust around me, but yeah, it just really did look out of place, and the photo came up very blue.
Okay, well, let me just give what information I have, and then I'll drop off the wiser people to give an answer. I know my limits, and I asked an atmospheric scientist at the School of Physics for some information. Here's the first piece of information. If you have incredibly small particles in the air, less than 3% of the wavelength of light, which is about half of a millionth of a metre, if you have incredibly small particles, less than 3% of that wavelength, for example, oxygen and nitrogen molecules, you will get the thing that the particle, because it's so small, sees only a small bit of the wave at a time, and therefore there is no, I'm going to talk technical talk, there is no phase shift, and therefore there is what they call dipole scatter, which is called Rayleigh scattering, which is called first order scattering, which is a subset of MIE scattering, which blah, 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 gives you the blue light, right? If you have very small particles, you get a blue sky. Second situation, the dust is bigger than 3% of the wavelength of light. Therefore, you get the phase change, you get the pattern changing, and you get the scattering going to mostly forward scattering of light and a little bit out the back. You get broadband scattering, which means it's evenly dropped across the whole wavelength. If you're getting a blue light visible on a photograph, there's something weird happening with very small particles. And I can't believe that particles would be of the wavelength of light. And so I'm going to have to go back to my clever guy. And if anybody's got an answer, please give us an answer on Twitter, Dr. Carl, DocTorKarl. And I freely admit that I'm out of my depth here.
Thanks for your call, David.
Thank you, Dr. David. You asked a deep one.
While we are on the topic of yesterday's storm, we've got Kevin from New South Wales with a bit of a question for you, Dr. Carl.
Thank you.
Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Both are very, very, very welcome. Just a quick question about the acid sulfate, issue with the soil that was destabilised yesterday.
Tell me more about that. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, as from limited knowledge I have, when, you know, you're sort of in certain areas when topsoil's either destabilised or eroded or for whatever reason, if there's an acid sulfate issue there, then it becomes very prevalent and you sort of have issues where it gets washed in the rivers and starts algal bloom and contaminating water supplies and all that sort of thing.
Where does this acid sulfate come from? Is it normally in the soil?
Well, it's in certain soils, yeah. It's there and until it's exposed to destabilised, from what I know, and again, only what I know, it's not a danger, but once it's exposed or gets in the river systems, it creates algal bloom and all that sort of thing.
Is it a few millimetres below the surface? Is it several metres? Is it...
Yeah, no, again, I suppose not being a geomorphologist or having sufficient knowledge in that area, I don't know, but
So under certain circumstances, this acid sulfate can go into the rivers. Is that what you're saying?
An area is where it exists and and the soil's eroded or exposed or through excavation or, you know, development or whatever, once it's exposed, reacts pretty heavily with water supplies.
Mm-hmm. And then?
And that what contaminates the dams, rivers, etc. Algal bloom and, you know, aquatic life suffer and, you know, normal, I suppose, habitats are disturbed for certain animals and, you know.
Right.
I'm just wondering, yesterday on such a mass scale, you know, what if you've come across it before, if it's a precedent, what happens then, you know, does it, you know, in certain, a lot of areas, like as I said, normally it only happens in certain pockets because it's usually man-made intervention. But yesterday was on such a massive scale, I just wondered.
Okay. I'm not a geomorphologist nor a soil agronomist. Mm. As a rough back-of-envelope calculation, if the storm is 100 kilometres by 100 kilometres, that means that there's 10 to the 10th square metres. Mm. And if you were to bring all of the soil to ground level, I reckon it'd be about 10 millimetres high. We're looking at about 100 million tonnes of soil, which is a significant amount of soil, which is leaving the centre of Australia. Some of it's landing on the coast, and we had stuff on our house and everybody had on their cars, and some will go into the ocean. I don't know about the coast. If a soil agronomist can give us an answer, I'd be ever so thrilled. Let me tell you what happens in the ocean. In many cases, iron is the limiting nutrient in the ocean. And what that means is that metabolic processes are stopped because there's not enough iron. If you fertilise the ocean with iron, as happened yesterday and is happening right now along the further north coast of Australia, you will have an you'll have a plankton bloom, and the little creatures will come along and eat. We will see a wealth of studies from this, but off the top of my head, Dr. Kevin, I don't know whether this. I think the soil would be good. I think it'll be good throwing this soil into our agricultural basins, but I'd need an agronomist to tell us the details.
Thanks for the call, Kevin.
Thank you, Dr. Kevin.
I think we might have to move on now. Let's move away from yesterday's storms, and we got Kerry from Victoria who has a question about super smellers for you, Dr. Carr.
Thank you.
Good morning, Kerry.
Hello, Kerry.
It's me on the radio.
Hello, Dr. Kerry. Good morning and welcome to the show.
Hello, Dr. Carl. How are you, darling?
Extra good, honey bunch.
You did a show many years ago, and I've rung many times just to get on to you, but it was about super smellers.
Yes.
And I was quite intrigued by it because, I mean, I can go to a shopping centre and get turned off by incontinence pads at 50 paces, put it that way. And I was hitchhiking when I was a younger girl at 14 and I used to smell danger. And then I lived overseas for many years and there were just people that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot barge pole. You know, you run away quickly.
Ah, what happens with menstrual cycles?
I was wondering about your super smellers theory.
What was my theory? I've forgotten.
Well, it was about smelling danger.
Ah.
Because it's an interesting theory because there are people who can see colours or see time, and there is this idea that senses do kind of mix together, isn't it?
Okay. Firstly, we'll talk a little bit about synesthesia. Synesthesia is a condition which happens to 1% of the population, but in variable degrees, or two variable degrees in those 1% of the population, where the senses get crossed over. And the way that practically anybody can experience synesthesia is either one, take LSD, which is illegal and dangerous, it is thought, and number two, get very, very tired, and just as you're on the point of falling asleep, arrange for somebody to slam a door in your house. And you will not hear, in my case, I don't hear it as a sound. I see it as a flash of light, and occasionally I feel it as a bunch of physical sensations running down the left or the right side of my body. And so
I thought that was just down to having too many children, where you stay awake all night and worry.
Oh, that's a different thing. Now, originally it was thought that each of your senses, such as sight, smell, taste, hearing, etc., would pick up electrical signals and then, or would pick up information and then send it via electrical nerve signals to one specific part of the brain and only that part of the brain. And it was thought that vision would go to the visual cortex, the Brodmann's areas 17 and 18 to the back of the head, etc., etc., etc. Now we know that, in fact, they're crossed over. Listen to Natasha Mitchell on Radio National, All in a Mind. She had a world expert from Texas talking on this, and he was saying that when you go looking, you'll find that your sense of the nerves running from your nose will go to the nose centre and to the hearing and to the vision. So we're all potentially wired up for it, but only 1% of us experience it as such. In your case with super smell,
I mean, I was experiencing this. I was called a witch in high school. I was 13 years old. Because I used to say, there's something wrong with you, honey. What's your problem? And it was like mind reading, and they used to get freaked out, and they called me a witch. Because I could smell something was wrong with people.
So it could be that either you were seeing or feel or hearing things, and that was translating into your sense of smell, and or there are so many different possibilities. I can't go all through them all, so I'll have to finish off soon.
That's okay.
And the other one is that you are more just plain and simple, more able to pick up different smells than the rest of us, and this has advantages and disadvantages.
Yes, it does.
For example, with regard to the so-called super tasters, they're very good at people who don't like broccoli, they're very good at avoiding toxins in the environment. Mm. But they don't like the taste of broccoli, and they don't have broccoli and the so-called cruciate vegetables with their anti-cancer properties. So in the short term, they're better at avoiding poisoning. In the long term, they're more likely to come down
with... I'm a great cook. No problems there, Jose.
All I can say is... Then I have to stop at this stage because it's such a big topic. We have to move on to something else, Dr. Carey.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Thank you
very much anyway.
Look, thank you for your fascinating insight into your life.
If it helps, I am Irish heritage going back 3 generations.
There may be some genetic something there happening, yes.
I think we're all witches.
thanks for your call, Carey. Dr. Carl's joining me this morning. My name is Dom Alessio, filling in for Zanro, who has gone home injured. If you have a question for Dr. Carl, please give us a call on 1300 055 36. We do have a call from Hannah from Melbourne. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning. My question for Dr. Carl. Hi, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Hannah, welcome.
Yep. I'm a new mum, and I read in the Australian Breastfeeding Association magazine that women who haven't given birth are able to lactate to feed a fostered or adopted child.
Yes.
I just wondered how on earth that can happen, because I thought that breastfeeding production of milk happens in response to giving birth and the hormones associated with that.
In general, yes, and it's designed to do that, and the system works darn well. And in his first year of life, my little son drank 3 times his mother's body weight in breast milk, 180 kilograms, which is an awful lot.
Yeah.
And the whales generate 0.5 ton per day as they swim up the east coast of Australia and back down again, feeding their babies. The phenomenon is called a wet nurse. And so among the wealthy and entitled in England, in some cases, they would, the wealthy noble woman would give birth and then immediately pass the baby to a wet nurse who was not the mother of the child, who would generate breast milk without having been pregnant. To grow a female breast, the male and female breasts are identical till puberty, and then the feminizing hormones kick in, the estrogen, etc., and then you grow the breast, which has all of the machinery in it for turning blood into milk. So blood comes into a breast and milk comes out. And a breast is, from an embryological point of view, a modified sweat gland. Not very romantic. The hormone that is needed to manufacture the milk is called prolactin, and it is manufactured in the brain. And so if you have high enough levels of prolactin in a man or a woman, the machinery will kick into action to some degree, more in a woman than a man, and start trying to make breast milk, regardless of whether they've been pregnant or not. The prolactin does it. Then there's another chemical called oxytocin. And this also is generated in the brain, and it causes contraction of the uterus as one effect, and also causes contraction of the muscles inside the breast. And so a woman can have a newborn baby and she's just sitting down to have a cup of tea and relax, and the baby's asleep, and the baby will wake up. And when I was an honorary mum, other nursing mothers would tell me that they could squirt 2 metres. That was the record.
Wow.
With the milk squirting out. So in general, the prolactin and the oxytocin are associated with the production and squirting out of the milk with pregnancy, but it can happen outside of pregnancy. I think there's some certain diseases involving Parkinson's disease and the treatment thereof, and there are cases of men in concentration camps at the end of the Second World War growing breasts and then generating milk.
I just have a question. Were there lactating competitions in that household?
Well, you see, this was at the baby health centres, and my wife was working in emergency medicine, and so I was staying at home. And so I'd go along with all the nursing mothers. I wasn't one myself with my baby, but I was the only one who was not a woman. And they'd say, oh, I was trying to feed my baby the other day, and the milk just started squirting out. And it's like trying to feed from a fire hose. You can't do it. So the baby has to get back, right? And then it ramped up. Oh, that's nothing. I've been able to do half a metre. I've been able to do 1 metre. Hey, back off, girls. I can do 2 metres.
Thanks for your call, Hannah.
No worries. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr.
Call.
Hannah.
Now, we've got some texts through on the text line about the guy who called up before who was talking about the blue sun.
Of which I failed to answer adequately, yes.
Now, Dave has texted in saying, isn't the red dust absorbing all the red light resulting in a shift to blue?
The red dust is absorbing the red light in the sense that white light lands on the red light. White light lands on the red dust. Every colour is being absorbed except for the red, which gets reflected off. But maybe there's some odd beams of blue wavelength light that manage to make it from the sun to our eyeball without hitting a red dust particle. But I think that's part of the answer, but I think there's more to it than that because they were talking about reflections.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm out of my depth. We need an optical scientist and an atmospheric scientist talking together. And I'm not surprised that something as simple as this requires such a complex answer.
If you're an optical scientist, please give us a call on 1300 055 36. Let's take another call now.
Well, we have an answer here on the Twitter.
Oh, we have an answer.
Acid sulfate soils are a result of sulfur-rich soils and rising water tables. We're having a trouble with that in Australia, mostly on the coast. Okay, wonderful. Oh, and I think the answer to the colour, I think you'll find that the red sky, oh, of course, the red sky was throwing the automatic white balance in the digital camera off. You see, if you've got a professional-grade digital camera, you set the white balance every time you're doing a shoot. In a smaller one, it'll just look around and say, I reckon that this is white, and I'll just average out. The average of all colours is 11% grey. That's what they reckon. If you get all the colours in the average scene, on average it's 11% grey. So maybe the automatic white balance was throwing things off and maybe there wasn't really extra blue light and we don't need a physicist. Anyway, go on, Dr. Dom.
Anyway, good morning. Hello, I think you might have to turn your radio down a bit there.
Okay, no worries.
No. Hello, no worries. Thank you so much for your patience. And
oh, it's like being in a strange reverberating vortex.
Yes, hi, I'm Felicity. I'm calling from Newcastle.
Hello.
Yes, so we have an answer to the question about the effect of the dust storm.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
And it's caused by retinal adaptation.
Yes.
And we just have that on a day like yesterday. Our eyes have a different coloured background or surrounding, and in the form of the dust in the sky, and our perception of the traffic lights is different too. And as the retina and the brain adapt to the different ambient colour of the sky, the shift in perception of all other colours as well.
So you reckon that the colour adaptation?
Oh, hold on. Can you please? You've got to turn that radio down because it's sounding very strange.
You've got an echo. Hello, are you there? She's turned everything off. But anyway, the adaptation can happen in the retina or in the brain. So your studies say that it happens in the retina.
Yes, well, I'm working with an optometrist here, and our optometrist said that there's a nerve cells in both the retina and the visual cortex of the brain try to automatically correct the difference.
Because the retina is not just simply a dumb CCD that picks up the light and sends it on, but there are 10 layers of cells in the retina going from the rods and cones, amacrine, bipolar, and even before the signal gets sent to the rest of the brain, your retina knows the difference between a black bar on a white background or a white bar on a black background. It also knows the difference between whether the bar is horizontal or vertical. So you're saying the processing is happening in the retina. Look, thank you very much, Dr. Felicity, and thank your optometrist friend as well.
That's okay, we will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Felicity. We have another call for you, Dr. Carl.
Mm.
Are they there? Good morning.
Hello.
Morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
It's Carl. Hello, good and morning. Welcome to the show. And who am I talking to?
Kalyani.
Look, thank you. Sorry, how do you say that?
It's Kalyani.
Can you spell
Kalyani.
That?
Kalyani, yeah, it's Indian.
And how do you spell that?
It's Kaly.
Yep.
Anii.
E-N-double-I.
Well, good morning,
well,
Dr.
Good morning,
Kaliani.
Dr. Kaliani. Thank you.
How are you?
Good. And you got a question or an answer for us?
Yeah, I did. I was just wondering, I've heard two people say, or lots of people say of my life, you know the whites that you get on your fingernails?
The lunules, L-U-N-U-L-E-S, yep.
Well, sometimes how you get, yeah, the white marks on your fingernails.
Oh, the white marks, which is supposed to be zinc or something.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a zinc deficiency or a calcium deficiency, but my partner thinks that it's just from knocking your fingernail and it's like it comes up in a white, like a bruise.
Ah.
And I just wanted to know whether it's true or not with about the deficiency. Like, I've had lots of people tell me that and I don't know what to believe.
My understanding is that the white marks that appear on your fingernail and then migrate down, I think, 1 millimetre every 7 to 10 days are due to trauma-type damage to the nail bed. I've asked a dermatologist about this and this is what they said to me.
Okay.
But that could be wrong. Right. There could also be a mineral deficiency as well, of which I'm not aware, but basically nail bed damage.
Damage to the nail. All right. Okay, he's laughing.
Is there somebody chuckling? Is this settle a bet time?
Yep. All right, well, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Kaliani. We have another call for you, Dr. Carl. And sadly, the systems that are supposed to tell me the names of the people who are calling in has decided to crash.
That's okay, no worries. And with whom are we talking?
Hello.
Hello, and your name, sir, or madam?
Jackson from Bensdale in Victoria.
Oh, Jackson, Dr. Jackson, and your answer or question is?
A few years ago, the bushfires in Victoria, it got so smoky where I live, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it went completely pitch black, and the street lights turned on and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And, we got out the video camera and decided to record some of it, just, you know, for keepsake. And I turned on the night vision to see a little better, and instead of only being able to see about, you know, 5-10 metres, I could see for hundreds of metres. I could see, you know, as far as I would have been able to see during the day.
What was going on?
My theory was, I'm not sure if it's correct, that I think the clouds were blocking all the visible light, but the infrared light was probably still getting through the clouds, and that was picking up on the night vision.
Dom,
but I wasn't sure.
I think you're right. Now, Dom is my colleague here in the studio.
Yes.
I think we should get Jackson's address and send him a Triple J fun pack, because he hit it in one. So we're looking, the fun pack's actually fairly crappy. It's just sort of free crap that they got lying on their desk that they send off to you. But
that's not into, well.
No, okay, we'll try and find something better, like a copy of JMag.
Oh, sweet.
So in the mist, now I should point out that firstly I talked about how oxygen and nitrogen particles are less than 3% of the wavelength of light. And they give you this blue thing happening. How normally dust is much bigger than 3% of the wavelength of light, so you just get all the colours being brought down on average the same, except when it's red dust, then it sucks out the red. Now, here's another thing to just muck everything up. Particles from smoke can be as small as individual molecules of carbon or two carbons stuck together. They can be the size of oxygen, nitrogen molecules. They can cause the Rayleigh scattering. They can cause this blueness, enhanced blueness. In your particular case, the small particles were stopping visible light. So how far could you see with your naked eye?
Oh, yeah, I could see you to the horizon.
With
my naked eye? Yeah. Oh, it was pitch black.
But
it
how
was
far?
Nighttime.
Okay, so you can see maybe 20 metres or something.
Oh, if that, you know. Yeah. Well, how far can you see without
But looking through the viewfinder of your camera, which had a CCD, you could see to the horizon.
Yeah.
Now, here's an experiment for everybody to do. Get your ordinary camera in your phone or your digital camera, still camera, or your video camera and look through the viewfinder and then get somebody to aim a remote control at it.
Oh, it flashes.
With your naked eye, you see nothing, but the camera can pick up infrared.
Wow.
So the fact that I've done this, so that proves that you can pick up the infrared coming out of the remote control. And so based on that, I would be willing to bet that, in fact, the infrared penetrates through the smoke and you could see to the horizon.
It was. I put a video up on YouTube because it just blew me away.
So, look, we'll now give our community safety a message. If you are caught in a bushfire and you cannot see, turn on your camera and look at, and follow the image that the camera gives you. And it might give you, and if it gives you greater vision, hey, you've got yourself an extra lever to save your life with. This has been a Triple J community announcement. Written
and
authorised by...
You could just stay away from the flames. That works too, you know.
Well, number two, you can stay away from the flames. Well. Written and authorised by Dominic Lisa, Triple J. Thank you very much, Dr. Jackson.
Thanks, Jackson. Hang on the line there. We'll grab your details.
Wait, thanks, Rob.
And I think we'll take one more caller with this crazy system of ours.
And then go to a song.
And go to a song. Good morning. Who do we have on the line now?
It's Chris.
Hello, welcome, Dr. Chris. You got a question or an answer for us?
Yes, I do. Hello, Dr. Carl, by the way. Sorry.
Hello, Dr. Chris.
How are you?
Very peachy keen.
I was on a flight from Melbourne to Hobart a couple of weeks ago, and it was pretty much sunset, and I know you're not supposed to do it, but I was looking kind of directly at the sun. Now, yep. The sun had kind of white lines going around it, so you could actually like look at it without hurting your eyes. Mm-hmm. Now, what I was wondering is, A, why that effect is caused, and the other one is, B, in regards to the blue tinge that everybody's been talking about in the past few calls, would that be an effect of possibly the solar flares off the sun?
Whoops.
Reflecting?
Solar flares?
Oh, like you know, how obviously the sun's quite hot, but would there be like little kind of flares of heat that might be kind of implemented that kind of reflect a different light than what the obviously usual sun would?
The sun is a fairly constant candle. It varies its output by one part in a thousand or 0.1% over roughly an 11-year cycle. Sometimes more, sometimes less. Recently, the sun has been quiet. It's been cooling down for the last 10 years or so, and it's about to kick up again. I don't think the solar flares are a part of it. But getting back to your other thing, did you see rays coming out like spokes on a bicycle wheel from the setting sun and centered on the sun?
No, it was more just because it was obviously being in a higher altitude, it was pretty much quite a clear evening.
Mm-hmm.
So all it was just the sun just basically going behind some clouds, and it was just a white kind of the outer line of the sun just kind of doing like backward circles, so to speak, like it just circling around the actual outer edge of the sun itself. Like it's just a brighter white light, because obviously when the sun sets it's a little bit more of a orange tinge to it. But this is just a really bright white light that was circling around the actual sun's perimeter, so to speak.
There was a circle of light around the sun.
Yeah, like I don't know if it's just because of, I guess, your eyes playing tricks on you or not, because you're looking at something brighter than what you're used to.
Ooh.
Just a white light that kind of goes like clockwise and then anti-clockwise around the sun.
Was it actually moving, rotating?
Yeah. Like
what, once a second, once every 10 seconds? Once a minute?
No, it was just constantly.
Oh, so it wasn't rotating. Now, was it even in brightness in the circle that it made, or was it brighter at certain points in the circle?
Yeah, it was kind of brighter at certain points. So it kind of stopped, and then it will go back the other way, and then it will go back the other way. So, it got brighter, stopped, and then went back again, and then it got brighter.
There are many things that are involved. I don't think it's crepuscular rays. I don't think that it is the case of the sun dog. I don't know what it is at that range. I'm out of my depth. Look up sun dog,
yep.
S-U-N-D-O-G, on Wikipedia. Look up crepuscular ray, C-R-E-P-U-S, crepuscular, C-U-L-A-R, crepuscular ray, and see if any of those strike a bell. But there are so many things that we don't understand. It was only as recently as the late 1960s that we fully understood the rainbow, and most of the other phenomena in the sky we don't understand.
You mean there's not a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow?
Shh, that's a secret. Damn.
Thanks for your call, Chris.
Thank you for
Thanks,
that difficult one, Chris.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.
Thank you.
Some answers for us, I
yes,
believe.
Yes, we have a few. One from Twitter. Acid sulfate soils are caused by soils that have been under seawater Another answer is acid sulfate soils are sulfides, mainly pyrites, P-Y-R-I-T-S, laid down during Holocene period and oxidized when exposed to water when the water table is lowered. And separately from that, with regard to the wet nurses and breastfeeding, etc., yep. I work livestock and lots of sheep as wet nurses when the other mother is too ill or leaves the lamb. So that works well. Thank you very much, Dr. Trenta. And Chris Smith, who's from the Naked Scientist in the United Kingdom, is visiting Australia at the moment. And catch his show, Naked Scientist. They've got all sorts of good podcasts and live radio, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been talking about this in the break. And he's saying that he reckons that it's happening, you know, the strange colour, the blueness
yep.
of the sun, is happening mainly in the retina, and mainly not in the nerves, but in the pigment. Now, you can pick up three main colours. You have cells in your retina that are sensitive to green at 550 nanometers, at red at 575 nanometers, and blue at 440 nanometers. If you are in a world that is red, you're burning up that red pigment like crazy.
Yeah.
But you're not burning up much blue or much green. And suddenly you aim your eyeballs directly at the sun. You're looking straight at the sun, which is much closer to white. And you're looking at it with a retina that has had a lot of the red pigment burnt up. Well, then the balance shifts to the blue.
Yeah,
you're seeing it as bluish. So it is not a physics phenomenon of optics in the air between the sun and your eyeball, and not a neural thing in the eyeball, not a neural thing in the rest of the brain, the Brodmann's areas 18 and 19 or 17 and 18, but rather, with Chris Smith saying, it's in the retina with the chemicals that turn light into electricity. Oh, and by the way, your retina is so sensitive that when fully dark adapted, your retina can pick up one single photon. You can't get better than that. That's the absolute limit.
That is pretty amazing.
Yes.
Anyway, Chris. All right, we have Mark on the line. Good morning, Dr. Mark.
Hello, Dr. Mark.
Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Now, you've got a bit of a story about the red dust in New Zealand, I believe.
Yes, I do, yeah. The wife and I did a trip over there a few years ago, and we were lucky enough to do a glacier walk on Fox Glacier. And we were talking to the guide, and he was just mentioning how there was red veins in the ice that was coming through, and apparently it was from a dust storm that we had back here. I think it was about 99 or around that time. That's a lot of our dust ends up over there in their snow. So it was just quite interesting to see, you know, the red veins in the ice and find out that it was actually Australian soil in New Zealand.
Ah, well, in Greenland, by analysing the ice going back a few thousand years, they've been able to follow lead production in the Roman Empire in Italy 2,000 years ago. And there was a spike of lead in Greenland. And lead particles are heavy. And they made it all the way to Greenland. So I wouldn't be surprised that, given the right winds, that the dust could make it to New Zealand. And thank you very much for that fascinating story, Dr. Mark.
No worries, Dr. Carl. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Oh, there we go. Pressing buttons left, right and centre. Alrighty, we've got Kylie on the line. Good morning, Dr. Kylie.
Good morning. How are you, Dr. Carl?
Very well, thank you, Dr. Kylie. You've got a question or an answer for us?
I've got a question for you. Yesterday I went for a drive, drove from Gympie to Noosa, and you know how you get out of the car, like we had the dust storm as well, way up in Queensland. You know how you get out of the car and you get an electric shock?
Yes.
Well, I went to meet my stepdad at the pub and I was zapped him, and then I went to press the poker machine and the whole poker machine blacked out.
You killed the poker machine. Yeah. You are doing God's work. Because gambling is basically taking money from the poor people and redistributing it to the wealthy people.
It wasn't my poker machine, it was my stepdad's, but I blacked it, the whole thing out. And now this morning my phone doesn't work and my computer doesn't work as well.
I'm sorry about the other ones. I can understand it. I can have joy at a poker machine dying, but not your computer.
Yeah.
What happens is that with the dust particles being so small, and they are very, very fine indeed. They have a large surface area, and under the right circumstances of dryness, of wind, of rubbing against each other, they can build up quite a large electrical shock. It is well known that you can have, with dust storms, you can have associated with dust storms electrical shocks.
This, like, my dog even zapped me. Like, I got zapped off my dog as well.
This is something I didn't even think of, Dom, but it's entirely reasonable that if you're building up a static charge, you can kill your computer.
Yeah.
I know this sounds dumb.
But you'd have to be generating a lot of electricity to be able to do that.
You don't generate it. You pick it up as static electricity from the cloud of dust that's all around you. It's so fine you can't see it. And if you're wearing any sort of reasonable shoes, they're insulating. There are special rubber shoes that
I have
people...
Done.
Yeah, they'll insulate you and you'll keep your charge. There are special rubber shoes worn by people who work in oil refineries and other spark hazardous areas which have graphite embedded in them. So, in the case that this happens next time, one, there's a big dust storm and you don't want to kill your computer. And I'd be willing to bet actually that there'd be a lot of people whose computers and other electronic equipment would have died because of the static electricity. One, get hold of some of these special conductive rubber shoes and wear them. Or two, wrap some copper wire around your belly with some acid, with some jelly that you've made up with some salt in it and held in with gaffer tape on your tummy and trail a ground antenna behind you. This is not necessarily practical. Number three.
That would be an interesting look, though.
That would be an interesting thing. Number three, before you touch, I know this is really hard, before you touch any electrical equipment, go to the water taps in the sink.
Yep.
And then just touch them. They're earthed. Okay. And then that way you'll you'll earth yourself.
Because I can go up to the radio even and it can go staticky and then I can walk away from it.
Yeah, look, I remember the very first time I bought a fax machine, I took it in to be serviced and the guy said at the service place, he said, there'll be a delay of about 2 or 3 weeks. And I said, why? And he said, you know that electrical storm that went through Bankstown last week? And I said, yes. He said, you can track the exact path of that electrical storm by the addresses of all the fax machines I have in here for repair because they got hit by the electrical storm hit the power lines, spikes went through the electrical system and killed the fax machines. With all of our wonderful electronics, they work on very low voltages. So for anybody who's listening in Queensland, if you just earth yourself to a tap before you touch your computer or your phone or your mobile phone or anything delicate electronically because you could kill it. Look, I'm really sorry, Kylie, but look, you've done a lot of good by people by alerting them to the fact that they can kill their equipment so other people will benefit from your suffering and hopefully it's insured, maybe under house insurance or something. I don't know.
Thanks for
Thank you very much, Dr. Carl.
Thank you, Dr.
Thanks
Kylie.
For your call, Kylie. I think we've got time for one more. We've got Jai. Good morning, Jai.
Good morning.
And now want to ask Dr. Carl about the smell that we were talking about before, about the woman who called up and could smell fear.
No, not particularly.
Okay.
It's sort of like that. But,
go on.
What I was wondering, Dr. Carl,
yep,
is that the amygdala in the brain,
yes,
when, say, if you've been in a battlefield or something, because I'm studying neuroscience at school at the moment.
Yes.
So if you've been in a battlefield and smell runs through the amygdala, so if you smell something that smelt like something from your past, you'll get flashbacks from when you first smelt that.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, why is it that it's smell and not sight or touch or hearing or any of the other senses?
Ah. So what's your question? Why?
Is it smell that runs through the amygdala?
Right. Okay, the amygdala is related to danger.
Yes.
To sensing danger.
Yep.
And to sensing fear. And there was a case of a woman who had a rare calcifying disease.
Yeah.
So that her amygdala got calcified and she could no longer sense fear. And so she was perfectly happy to step off the pavement in front of a bus.
Ah.
And she had to be retaught to know that this is danger and that you should have fear.
Yep.
It's in the brain. It's a little organ like a little almond or something.
Yeah.
A little tiny thing.
And that's why it has that name.
Secondly, it's related to your sense of personal space.
Yep.
They came across Professor, I just read this a few weeks ago, Ralph Adolphs, I'm just reading this off the file I copied, Ralph Adolphs, A-D-O-L-P-H-S, the Bren Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at some university, which I can't find fast enough, did a study with a woman who had a damaged amygdala on both sides of her brain, and normally you stay about 60 centimetres away from a person. She will get right up in their face and stand 30 centimetres away, and sometimes even 10 centimetres away, she's got no sense of personal space because of damage to her amygdala. Thirdly, why does it relate to your sense of smell? Smell is in your brain stem. Every living creature has a sense of smell.
Yes.
Humans, primates, fish, even bacteria.
Yes.
Their sense of smell is just a few receptors on the outside of the cell that pick up that there's something either good that they should eat or something bad that they have learnt is a threat and that they should run away.
Yep.
Smell is hardwired into the very core of your danger system. If you read the series of books by Marcel Proust, P-R-O-U-S-T, called Days of Future Past or Remembrance Past, in there he talks about how he smells a Madeleine cake, and then suddenly the memory of visiting his aunt who made these Madeleine cakes rises up in front of him like an entire village, and it brings it out live. And people can have their sense of smell like the sense of smell of a chalkboard at school or whiteboard ink or their first girlfriend or boyfriend. They smell that somewhere else and suddenly it brings back the whole experience. The reason the sense of smell is so powerful is because it's hardwired into your danger system at a very primitive root level. And not every living creature has a sense of hearing or vision.
Yep.
But we all have a sense of smell. Smell is incredibly powerful, Dr. Jai.
Thanks.
Because it's wired into the hard brain.
And my other thing was, I did a bit
I'm sorry, Jai. We are actually running out of time. So thank you so much for your call.
And last one, Jai. It's the August 30 issue of the magazine called Nature Neuroscience that deals with the amygdala and the sense of space. Sorry, back to you, Dr. Tom. Sorry.
Thanks for your call, Jai. We have run out of time. It's been a pleasure once again to have you in the studio, Dr. Carl.
Thank you, Dr. Tom.
You will be back next Thursday from 11 p.m.
From Taiwan.